Good morning. I hope you all, like me, have been enjoying these fall days. It's truly been a blessed time. And I'm glad they're moderate because we haven't turned the heat on yet. And we started to. It wouldn't come on. So we don't need it yet. But I've got a part ordered. And it should be here before the cold weather comes, hopefully. All the contraptions we use in life to make ourselves comfortable do sometimes break down. And we realize how fortunate we are. It's quite convenient just to be able to go punch some buttons on the wall and change your environment, isn't it? Not have to go out and cut a tree down or something like that. Isaiah talks a little bit about that process of warming yourself by wood in today's lesson. And it's a great way to heat, but it is a little more work than punching those buttons on the wall. So in Isaiah 44, we have another outstanding chapter. And it begins like this. Yet now hear, O Jacob my servant, and Israel whom I have chosen. Okay, and so let me just remind myself and you, since you're listening to me, what we have happening here in Isaiah is a combination of things. Isaiah's writing as a prophet, but he's also writing to real people in his time who were contemporary with him. And he sees the things that God has laid open before him on different levels. So on the one hand, in the nearer term, he sees the sin of Israel. He sees how they have failed God. He sees how they continue to transgress the will of God. He sees their coming captivity, and yet he is interested in comforting them that that is not the end, that there is a redemption coming. But then as well, God has given him a far vision of a much greater kind of redemption, which extends beyond just the people of Jacob, into a sort of idealized chosen people of God who are chosen by faith. Now, some of that is revealed to us later. But anyway, Isaiah is seeing that as well. And so we're kind of sifting through this. And as far as the contemporary picture is concerned, he's constantly going back to one of his favorite topics. And that is the futility of worshiping idols. Isaiah is like, this is the stupidest thing ever. And in today's lesson, he really probably is at the zenith of his appeal to the lunacy of idolatry. So we'll see that a little later in the chapter. But he is here now appealing to Jacob. To Israel, whom I have chosen. Thus saith the Lord that made thee and formed thee from the womb, which will help thee. Fear not, O Jacob, my servant, and thou, Jeshurun, whom I have chosen. Okay, so you might not have expected that term there. He's alternating here between Jacob and Israel. And so here again, you might expect Jacob and Israel. This is a term, I think it shows up maybe three times in the Old Testament, first time in Deuteronomy, which is a little bit puzzling to commentators, but it seems to be an endearing term that is being used here. So we find it in this verse.
An endearing term
For Israel. Yes. Let's see if there's anything easily accessible by cursor method here. Upright one. So, yeah, it's not one you'd use in times of their sinfulness and rebellion, certainly, but projects the chosen people that God would like to see, the upright ones who are upright because they follow his will. So he says, "Fear not, for I will pour water." Upon him that is thirsty, and floods upon the dry ground. I will pour my spirit upon thy seed, and my blessing upon thine offspring. And they shall spring up as among the grass, as willows by the watercourses. One shall say, I am the Lord's. Another shall call himself by the name of Jacob. And another shall subscribe with his hand unto the Lord and surname himself by the name of Israel. Okay, so that describes a people whose desire it is, perhaps even a people who are not Jewish by nature, to be a part, but whose desire it is to be affiliated with this chosenness that God describes here. We find in life that sometimes people want to change their names. Names are important. I've met a number of people in my life that I felt sorry for because of the names that they had inherited. We have ways, I guess, to fix that. I heard that the new King Charles had considered at one point changing his name because of the history of King's Charles in the past. Apparently that's not going to happen. So the name here, the surname, of course, refers to the family name. Interesting way to talk about this attraction to being connected with God's people. I'm going to pardon me, I just thought I had a mouse coming toward me or something. It was a little colored wheel. I didn't get up on the chair and scream or anything. Rolled away. We'll have to sing that song, won't we? But at any rate here, these are words of comfort. God says, I have chosen you. I have formed you. I have brought you into being. And the implication is, I'm not throwing you away, even though you deserve it.
Reaching out to others in a sacrificial way?
It would be wonderful to have personal experience in those days to answer more literally. I don't know of any. That doesn't tend to be the way people are. If you look at the history of man, It's a history of taking from others what is good. You know, if you have a given people who gets prosperous, that's a dangerous thing. Don't look too good or talk too wise, or your neighbor who may be more powerful than you may come and take your stuff. Right? It doesn't come to mind that there has ever been much of a sentiment of spreading the joy in that way.
Sometimes I just try to fathom what the world felt like.
Contextualize.
There was plenty of reaching out and sacrifice, but it was to reach out and sacrifice them.
I can't think of specific examples, but just in general, it seems like there has always been the hints of what was to come, you know, of the beauty of someone sacrificing themselves for someone else. Kind of laid the groundwork so that when it was done rightly and well, it wasn't foreign for people completely. But the way that God does it to man,
You know, during the time of the rise of the Roman Empire, certainly all the language of messiahship was attributed to the first Caesar. And he was portrayed as being a savior of the world. But keep in mind what being saved by the Roman Empire looks like, right? Okay, yeah, if you become part of their world, part of their culture, part of their structure, there are opportunities for you. But you lose your own identity. And by contrast, the Messiah of Christianity gave himself for the world rather than the world having to sacrifice itself for the goals and aims of the empire. And it's just, it's fascinating that these things both kind of came on the world scene at the same time. I mean, Jesus was a little bit later, just a few years, but it was an interesting development. So there is an ongoing interest on my part to better understand what it meant in the minds of Old Testament prophets as well as first century Christians, what it meant to them whenever this imagery of pouring of God's Spirit was used. And we find it used a lot. In the prophets, let me bring up some of my notes here. So already in Isaiah chapter 32, verse 15, we have the expression, until the Spirit be poured upon us from on high, and the wilderness be a fruitful field, and the fruitful field be counted for a forest. So that was back in 32. Here in 44, we have, I will pour my Spirit upon thy seed. We know that on the day of Pentecost, whenever Peter was trying to explain what was happening to the people of Jerusalem, he didn't quote Isaiah on the Spirit. He quoted the prophet Joel, where the same expression is used. I will pour my Spirit out. In Ezekiel 37, we have Ezekiel's vision of the dry bones. And let's just go there and look at that. Because I think it gives us another good example of this language, whether or not it totally explains everything we'd like to know. So Ezekiel sees the bones, and they were dry. In fact, they were very dry. And the Lord said unto him, can these bones live? And Ezekiel was a smart man. He said, you know. he wasn't going to chance it there. They looked pretty dry to him. Again he said unto me, prophesy upon these bones and say unto them, O ye dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord God unto these bones, behold, I will cause breath to enter into you, Okay, and so this word breath, by the way, is the Hebrew ruach, which is the same word spirit. It's talked about when I pour out my spirit. So I will cause breath or spirit to enter into you, and you shall live. I will lay sinews upon you, and bring up flesh upon you, and cover you with skin, and put breath in you, and you shall live, and you shall know that I am the Lord. And so then he goes ahead and narrates this scene. I prophesied, they got back their flesh, but there was no breath under them, or in them. And then another prophecy brought breath. And then I want to jump down to where God sort of explains this, because the breath that he talks about in the prophecy is the four winds of the earth. So it's a play on the wind breath identity in the behind the word. But he says in verse 11, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Behold, they say, our bones are dried, our hope is lost, we are cut off for our parts. Thus saith the Lord, behold, I will open your graves and cause you to come up out of your graves and bring you into the land of Israel. And ye shall know that I am the Lord when I have opened your graves, O my people, and brought you up out of your graves, and shall put my spirit in you, and you shall live. And I shall place you in your own land. Then shall you know that I am the Lord, or I the Lord have spoken it and performed it. And so there again, this language of God putting his spirit. Now in this particular example, it doesn't seem that there's any particular significance except that they're alive and they were dead, right? So it's talking about restoring them to the land. Certainly in the prophecy of Joel that Peter quotes, and in some of the places in Isaiah, there seems to be a suggestion of something more, something of greater significance than just a restoration to the land. So it's something that I don't have to my satisfaction all the dots connected, but I'm pointing out some of the dots for you here. Maybe you can beat me to it. Anyway, in verse 3, he says, I will pour my spirit upon thy seed and my blessing upon thine offspring. And then he uses the metaphor of growth. They shall spring up as among the grass, as willows by the watercourses. Continuing in verse 6, thus saith the Lord, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, that is, Israel's Redeemer, the Lord of hosts. I am the first, and I am the last, and beside me, there is no God. And who, as I, shall call and shall declare it and set it in order for me, since I appointed the ancient people and the things that are come and shall come, let them show unto them. Okay, so this is another shot across the bow of the idols, right? They're not talking. And yet I am. I am telling. I am the existent one, the first and the last, and the only one. There is no other.
To the ancient people, is that just forefathers?
Just looking at the past. So, yeah, it's ancient to by this time, to the ones that were then alive. Let's see, I don't know what the word actually is. So it's just a reference to a long time ago. After all, he is the first, and so his dealings with people date back to the very beginning. Verse 8, fear ye not, neither be afraid. Have not I told thee from that time, and have declared it? Ye are even my witnesses. Is there a God beside me? Yea, there is no God. I know not any. And depending on how you're conceptualizing this conversation, that can sound kind of funny. If you think of God saying, I don't know of any other gods. But it's a way of communicating. There is no knowledge of any. And so then he proceeds here to graphically describe this process of God-making that man engages in. He says, they have made a graven image. They that make a graven image are all of them vanity, and their delectable things shall not profit. They are their own witnesses. So, ye are my witnesses, God says. Your very existence is a witness to who I am. I brought you forth as the seed of Abraham. I brought you forth out of Egypt. I brought you through the wilderness. I brought you through all things. Ye are my witnesses. But the witnesses of the idols and those that make them, they are their own witnesses. They see not nor know that they may be ashamed. Okay? And I think you take that in the sense of they have not even enough sense to be ashamed. They don't have any sense. They can't see. They can't hear. Somebody who is a sentient being can be embarrassed by their lunacy if it's shown to them. But if you don't have the ability to sense, you're just up there on the shelf, right? You're a pretty little thing which isn't affected by anything. You're not going to be ashamed. You can't even perceive.
A guy I once worked with said, you can't insult me, I'm too stupid.
There you have it.
It's sort of.
Yeah, same. Same line of thought, isn't it? Who hath formed a god or molten a graven image that is profitable for nothing? Behold, all his fellows shall be ashamed, and the workmen, they are of men. Let them all be gathered together. Let them stand up. Yet they shall fear. They shall be ashamed together. Okay, so make an army out of them. Make them stand up for something. But they are nothing. The smith with the tongs both worketh in the coals and fashioneth it with hammers and worketh it with the strength of his arms. Yea, he is hungry and his strength faileth. Okay, so if you think about the process of creating this molten image or this idol, however you do it, whether it's molten or not, the process of creating it, if it's created by a man who himself is subject to fatigue, is subject to the whims of this world and the limitations of the body, if it's created by a man, how can it possibly transcend its creator? The creator is hungry. The creator, his strength faileth. If he drinketh no water, he is faint. The carpenter stretcheth out his rule. He marketh it out with a line. He fitteth it with planes. He marketh it out with a compass and maketh it after the figure of a man, according to the beauty of a man, that it may remain in the house, on the shelf. He heweth him down cedars, and taketh the cypress and the oak, which he strengtheneth for himself among the trees of the forest. He planteth an ash, and if you look at the different translations of these trees, there's some different varieties possible. Don't know why the King James translated this one as ash, although I like ash wood a lot. But most translators make it either a fir or cedar. Whatever the case may be. He planteth an ash, and the rain doth nourish it. Then shall it be for a man to burn. He will take thereof and warm himself. Yea, he kindleth it, he lights it, and bakes bread. Yea, he maketh a god, and worshipeth it. He maketh a graven image, and falleth down thereunto. He burneth part thereof in the fire, with part thereof he eateth flesh. He roasteth roast, and is satisfied. Yea, he warmeth himself, and saith, Aha, I am warm, I have seen the fire. And the residue thereof he maketh a god, even his graven image. He falleth down into it, and worshipeth it, and prayeth unto it, and saith, Deliver me, for thou art my God. Isaiah is clearly at his zenith of poking fun at this practice. He says, They have not known nor understood, for he hath shut their eyes and they cannot see, and their hearts that they cannot understand. And none considereth in his heart, neither is there knowledge nor understanding to say, I have burned part of it in the fire, yea, also I have baked bread upon the coals thereof. I have roasted flesh and eaten it. Shall I make the residue thereof an abomination? Shall I fall down to the stock of a tree? He feedeth on ashes. A deceived heart hath turned him aside, that he cannot deliver his soul, nor say, Is there not a lie in my right hand? And I've tried repeatedly to point out that we are truly missing something if we just think about these kind of practices as ancient. If we just limit them to the practice of ancient peoples in making images and fail to realize that as human beings, an idol is anything that takes the place of God in our life. Anything that we worship instead of Him. Anything that we dedicate all of our energies and mind to. Anything that we look to for deliverance in our lives. And so if you think about the way that humans tend to behave, what tends to drive them, what they build their temples to, you'll find their idols.
It's interesting, in the New Testament, I think it's Colossians, he says that covetousness, which is idolatry. So the things that we long after can become our idols.
Yes, when you think about what drives you, what you're passionate about, it reflects your values. Well, values tell you a tremendous amount about yourself. What do you value? What do you hold as most important?
If there's anything that we're not willing to let go of, then even if God says, I need you to let go of that, then we're choosing that over God.
And there's even, of course, I'm not criticizing it, but it's possible to make a loophole of the not willing to let go, right? Because it's like, well, I'm willing to, but since I'm willing to, I can pursue it with all my heart. You know what I mean? The fact is, if you're wholly given to it, you're not willing to. So just
sure.
For my sake, to point that out, that I don't want to be playing games with myself and say, oh, sure, I could give it up in a moment. So what are you going to do tomorrow and the next day, the next day? Well, I'm going to pursue it like it's the only thing there. And so that's part of the picture of putting us where we need to be before God, is realizing we need to look at what it is we're doing with our life, what it is we're giving ourselves to, what is it that gives us hope for the future, what do we see as the salvation for our unhappiness.
That verse 20 there has some really scary words in it, a deceived heart. So, yeah, and then he doesn't know that there's a lie. So when we deceive ourselves, and we don't even know it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
Normally that happens with things that aren't necessarily bad.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm just wrestling in my mind because, I mean, this is not just an easy thing to think through and decide, okay, you know, it's all good.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I try to separate, okay, what are the things that I do on a daily basis that bring me great joy?
Mm-hmm.
And clearly I've organized my life to where I want to be doing what God wants me to do, so I'm not doing things that I feel guilty for that I know are not appropriate. But it's like, is there a baseline? You know, do I spend as much time doing the activities of my day as I spend before Him in my mind? It's really tricky to know how to work through all of that in your head. You know, and
mm-hmm.
there are different things that give us joy.
And I would really avoid trying to make it easier for you, because it's the struggle that purifies your heart. It is the wrestling with the truth that brings you to recognize it.
And I wonder, too, if given our different personalities, some of us would tend to struggle more with, you know, like people need us, and so we can let some things go to help people. Where if we're a certain type of personality, it's easier to do that. Where a different type of personality would actually be more energized by being alone and doing something creative or whatever. So it's going to be different struggles for sure for each one of us in hearing His call.
Mm-hmm.
About what to do with our time, because I definitely don't want to be, you know, I can look at the world and I can see, yeah, all you talk about is your sports games and who's winning and who's losing, and I'm thinking, man, where's your time for God? And then I'm thinking, okay, what am I doing that's in any way like that? You know, just, it's just a constant
mm-hmm.
analyzing and trying to be careful that I know myself.
And, you know, it's always important that we do look carefully at ourselves. It can be a distraction to see the badness of others, the wrongness of others, and feel comforted, well, I'm not that bad. I'm not like that. And ultimately, it doesn't matter where they are. The question is where we are, right? So not saying that you're on the wrong track there, but just reminding myself that I want to please him independently of everything else that's going on. And their badness doesn't make me look good.
Absolutely. It's just so easy to see somebody else and not as easy to see me. So definitely.
So you do the comparison because you're also a human and you can be doing something analogous whether you're doing the same thing or not.
And I really figure I am. I need to figure out where it is. I mean, I live long enough to know that probably there's somewhere I'm not seeing that I need to.
And then some people need to be told, you're just agonizing too much about things, you know. Just give your all to Jesus and go for it. And don't try to analyze yourself to death. Some people need to hear that occasionally because he does care about you. It's not that you're going to get holy because you're so good at self-analyzation. You establish your place before him by trusting him, by giving yourself to him. And at some point you say in your life, Lord, I've looked at it as long as I can. I don't see anything else. You'll have to show me if there's something else. And I'm trusting in you until then.
That's a place of rest.
Yes, that's where you can rest.
I think it's our been there, done that.
Mm-hmm.
My desire for I've done all, you know, I checked all the boxes, this is idolatry, this is not, and I definitely am not in the idolatry camp, so phew. And hearing people talk about self-analyzing and thinking through, is there an area, and probably is an area and you haven't found it yet, just left me in turmoil until I learned what trust really meant. And then it's I am in a trust relationship with God, and he knows that until the day I die, I'm going to be in the process. And so at this moment, if my heart truly is in a place of, I'm willing to see anything you want to show me, or you want to show me through other people, or whatever, and so then his evaluation of me is complete. I am where I should be, even though I still have growing to do. And so then you can still be looking at things in your life, you can still be looking for God to show you things, and yet be completely content and at peace before him, knowing that it's all clear, but there's still growth to happen.
Right.
It's a tricky thing, especially for humans, when we're so black and white, we like to be able to check it off.
Absolutely. But you know, one of the reasons that we go down this line of thought when we're in Sunday school is we're all in different places, right? And so there are those of us that need to be reminded of this, and also to help us to realize that it's not just about people a long time ago that really were pretty stupid. I mean, look, they take a tree and they burn part of it and they cook their bread on part of it and they make a god out of the rest of it. How stupid can you be? Well, about as stupid as we are. That's how stupid you can be. That's the point. And I want to always remember that whenever I read verses like this. But
it immediately came to mind when I was reading that someone came through the drive-thru and they had a 8-year-old in the back, and it was clear that he was the idol.
Okay.
The window, I mean, I won't go into all of it, but it was like, wow, she is bowing down to his least little whim and his least, and it's like, well, you created, you created that person, and now you are bowing down to. it's easy to do.
Mm-hmm. Create your own little terrace there. Huh? So Isaiah here, like I say, is definitely at the zenith of his rhetoric against the idols in this chapter. Verse 21, remember these, O Jacob and Israel, for thou art my servant. I have formed thee. Thou art my servant, O Israel. Thou shalt not be forgotten of me. I have blotted out as a thick cloud thy transgressions, and as a cloud thy sins. Return unto me, for I have redeemed thee. Now, there's a verse for you. Sometimes we get this idealized image of the structure of things in our mind. God is the ultimate just judge, and if we break his commandments, we must pay the penalty. There's nothing left to say, basically. And yet, here he says to the nation, which clearly has broken his will in so many ways, I have blotted out thy transgressions. I have, as a cloud, hidden thy sins. Return to me, for I have redeemed thee. And that just really messes with our mind, because it's supposed to be, you don't get forgiven until you ask for it, right? You don't get forgiven until you return. And let me just tell you, don't count on it. but if you look at, God's dealings with man as a whole, that's not how he's treated us. He didn't wait on the cross for us to come to him asking for forgiveness. And he prefigures that here, I think, in his dealing with the nation of Israel. I'm making the first step. Not just the first step, I am making the difference. I am redeeming you. But then he appeals to them, return to me. It's still in their hands as to how they respond. I don't know if you have ever encountered the line of thinking that is encapsulated in the term vindictive justice. There are those who maintain that God's justice is a vindictive justice, and that it is not possible for him to forgive sins unless they are punished. And there's a line of logic that surrounds that. It seems to me that this verse pretty much contradicts that notion. Now, they might try to say, well, okay, so punishment comes. He punishes himself, in essence, to do this. But I'm not sure there's any reason to go down the route that they go to start with. It's always a challenge to dictate to God what he's like. And I really find it a much more appropriate place to put myself in to ask him what he's like. My logic, my philosophy, doesn't control the reality of God. And the reality I see here is a God who chooses. And he says in another passage, for my own sake, for my namesake, I'm doing this because I have a plan. I have an end. I know what I'm doing. But what I'm doing is, I am blotting out your transgressions. Return unto me. I think that's an important verse.
And that, you pointed out, you just gave another example. If our logic confines God to something besides what he is, then we're not really serving God. We have created an idol.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think about how Jesus demonstrated this. I know he said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. So that's certainly of the same sort of spirit.
When he stood over Israel or Jerusalem and said, how oft I would have gathered you. It's clear he's wanting, even in their state of rebellion against him, he's wanting to pull them in if they would just. I mean, it is, it's something that we even live, I mean, how many of us in any kind of close, broken relationship, it's like, I don't care what's happened in the past. Let's just restore. Mm-hmm. We did. There's no. I don't need you to grovel. I don't need. If you really care about the person, you just want the restored relationship. It's already forgiven.
Yeah, but what if you've been hurt too bad to restore it?
It depends on how much you care about the other person. I would think in a situation like that you're caring more about your own. And I don't mean that lightly. I get pain, and it's not something you just blow off. But if the focus is on the care for the other person.
Well, and there's also the issue of trust. I mean, you could have a situation where somebody's not changed at all, and they will literally tear your world apart, you know, your family or whatever. And so you don't, even though you would love to have a good relationship with them, you have to keep your distance because of the damage. Mm-hmm. You may still wish for good for them and care for them.
Yeah, but I'm still saying, what about the hurt? How do you overcome the hurt that you've experienced?
Over and over again, you look at Jesus and you realize he gave, though it hurt more than we can imagine, and if I'm going to follow in his footsteps, he can carry that for me. He can help me carry that, and just, there's a healing that happens when I lay it on him. I'm not hurt as much as he has.
Okay, so not as much as him. What does a hurt usually consist of in relationships?
Self-centeredness, and I've been that way to others and probably hurt them. So what?
So that's the cause of it. What does it consist of in your experience? What does the hurt consist of? You know what I'm saying?
Protection. I don't want to. I mean, I respond to hurt by not wanting that to happen again.
It's something that takes a shot at your self-worth or your value as a person or something. When I'm hurt, I feel like my self-worth or my value has been underestimated or chiseled down or something.
It's also the trust part, though. I mean, that's where deep hurt comes from, is you've trusted someone, you've given them access to the good.
Yeah, the same actions against you can create totally different experiences on your part depending on where the actions come from.
Right.
You know, if you're in a crowd and somebody yells across the street at you, you idiot, why don't you go away? It's like, they got a problem. I don't know them. But if somebody that is close to you and you trust says that, that creates a pretty deep scar.
So, in answer to your earlier question, is that the breach of trust is what creates the hurt? Or Because it still would sort of be under my, and I'm not trying to defend my answer either. I'm just trying to put it in context of the trust set. So if somebody who I don't know from Adam says you're an idiot, like, well, they're taking a shot at my self-esteem or something, but I don't really care, so it doesn't hurt much.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who I really trust does the same thing. Mm-hmm. That hurts a lot more.
Mm-hmm. So trust is a factor that can accentuate the hurt. But I guess the point that we eventually would need to get to is, are there ways to alleviate the hurt? How do we take this experience, which on the one hand we can hold on to the hurt, we can nurse it, right? And we can make it fester. And the only source I've found to alleviate the hurt is to embrace the assessment of God as my Redeemer. Where he says, you know, I have formed you. I know you. And you're valuable to me. And that ultimately gives us the power to reject the hurt from continuing to control us. And even embrace the possibility of reconciliation with the person who caused it.
Hurt is one of those things, again, that if you won't let go of it,
mm-hmm.
there's some idolatry going on there.
What are you idolizing?
It's a little complicated, but
what are you idolizing? At the back of it all, probably somewhere, yourself, your rights. Mm-hmm. I need justice for this, so you set yourself up somehow. Mm-hmm. But you probably won't. You don't recognize that it's.
And I think then, too, your image of yourself. So you have this notion of who I am and my importance, and somebody has destroyed it by the way they've treated you. And you're saying, oh, no, that's not, this is, I'm going to hang on to this. Well, I heard the bell, so I'll stop there. I had no idea we were going there this morning, but sometimes things just develop. Thank you for your kind attention.